Okay, so we're talking now about rickettsial infections. And we're going to start off by talking about African tick typhus. So I think you will remember this patient I told you about yesterday, who was 25 years old. He'd been on holiday in southern Africa. He became unwell with a fever and rash and some lymphadenopathy. And my first thought was that he had been in southern Africa. He had probably been in a game park and been bitten by a tick, like many patients we see. Here he was with a spotted fever, but when we took a further history, we discovered his recreations had not been out of doors, but more indoors, and he actually had an HIV seroconversion illness. So just to emphasize again the importance of taking a good history and finding out exactly what your patient has been doing and where he has been. So this was another patient, the same age, 25 years old, had been on holiday for 2 weeks in South Africa and came back 2 days before we saw him. He gave a 4-day history of fever and rash. So we asked him what he had been doing in southern Africa. He traveled with his wife, no other sexual contacts. He had been to the Kruger National Game Park, which is in South Africa, on close to the border with Mozambique, and a very popular destination for tourists. So when we heard this story, we thought, well, he almost certainly does have African tick typhus. So where is the eschar? So we examined him carefully, and we indeed found that he had this lesion with a black center, typical of the eschar of African tick typhus. This is the site of inoculation where he was bitten by the tick. And usually you find this on the legs or in the groin. Patient is not always aware they've been bitten by a tick. It's remarkable how painless a tick bite can be. So he was not aware that he had been bitten by any ticks, but we found this eschar, which clinically confirmed our diagnosis. So African tick typhus is caused by a particular species of rickettsia known these days as Rickettsia africi, which is easy to remember. It's transmitted by ticks, which are common in southern Africa. And we see this, as I said, frequently in tourists returning from southern Africa, but it apparently is also endemic in the West Indies, and it's thought that those ticks were transported to the West Indies as a result of the slave trade hundreds of years ago. So the clinical features, there are asymptomatic infections among children living in endemic areas, but we don't see them. So in the cases that we see in returning travelers, they present with fever. 50% or more will have a rash, which is usually a maculopapular rash, such as the one I showed you, but occasionally vesicular. And you will find an eschar, again, in more than 50% of cases. And these African ticks are quite aggressive, so you may find more than one. They've been bitten by more than one tick, and you find multiple eschars. And there is often regional adenopathy around the site of the inoculation. Investigations. So there may be a low platelet count, sometimes evidence of some hepatic involvement. Diagnosis is by serology, which is not highly specific. If possible, we would prefer to confirm it by PCR. And treatment is with doxycycline daily for the exact duration that you should give it for has not really been worked out. We would normally treat for 3 to 5 days. In the case of pregnant women or children, azithromycin is the alternative, and these cases will respond very rapidly to treatment. So I'm handing over now. That was African tick typhus, and Jamie Whitehorn is going to talk about scrub typhus, which is a problem mainly in Asia.
Thank you, David. So I'm going to talk, moving on to scrub typhus, which is caused by a rickettsial disease called Orienta tsutsugamushi, and it affects this triangle of countries in Asia and down into northern Australia, which is referred to as the tsutsugamushi triangle for people working in that field. This tick is not actually the vector of scrub typhus. It's just there to catch you out. So the case here is a 60-year-old farmer who presented to a hospital in Laos and presented with a 7-day history of fever and 2 days of a dry cough. So you want to know, as we talked about a lot over the course of the last couple of days, exactly what he's been doing, where he's been, how long, what the symptoms are, and going into more detail about the history and risk factors. He's a previously fit and well man, and he'd been doing nothing unremarkable except working in his farm local, near the hospital you were working at. He was febrile on examination at 39 degrees. He was slightly jaundiced. He was hypotensive with a blood pressure of 90 over 55, and he had some coarse crackles in his right lower zone in his chest and was confused. His blood test showed that he had a neutropenia, a thrombocytopenia, and evidence of deranged liver function tests and renal function tests. So he had an ALT of 300 and evidence of an acute kidney injury. So appropriately, he was tested for malaria and dengue, and those were both negative. So what other things would you want to know, and what would you like to do? Dr. Najam. This is his body. This is his torso. So you can see a prominent eschar as well in this patient as well. So he had a large eschar.
See, I mean, if you have a serology test for scrub, there are rapid tests.
There are. Yes, that's right. Yeah. I think that's very true. Yes. Thank you. So scrub typhus, sorry, I haven't done this very accurately. This is not the vector, and I don't know why this has managed to get its way into my slides, so apologies for that. I think I must have got confused with yesterday's talk about entomology. So scrub typhus is caused by Orienta tsutsugamushi, and it's transmitted by the leptotrombium mites, which do not look like that. And the larvae are the infectious organisms, but the adults maintain the infection, and it's transmitted from mother mites to their offspring by transivarial spread. And it can be maintained in these very small pockets called mite islands. So there can be very focal areas of transmission in rural parts of Southeast Asia. It causes a disease which is very similar to louse-borne typhus, which is not in our, we're not covering louse-borne typhus in today's talk, but it has a low mortality rate to that. And it's thought there are up to about 1 million cases per year, but it's massively underdiagnosed. So it's normally maintained in a rodent mite life cycle. As I mentioned, there are some mite islands where there's evidence of high levels of focal transmission. And in a way, humans are really accidental victims of scrub typhus, and it's not normally part of the life cycle of the disease. A study by our colleagues in Laos showed that it makes up a very high proportion of undifferentiated febrile illness in rural areas of Southeast Asia in particular, and in that region that's illustrated by that triangle in the map at the beginning. So including doxycycline and empiric treatments in patients who present with sepsis in this part of the world is not unreasonable. I've shown this map before. So it spreads all the way from India down to Indonesia and to northern Australia. So the clinical features, the incubation period is about 12 days. Typically, there's an eschar at the bite site, like African tick typhus. It can present with very non-specific symptoms like fever, headache, retrobulbar pain, and myalgia, and also a macropapular rash, which, if you remember from my dengue talk yesterday, almost mimics the dengue presentation symptoms identically. Severe complications are seen relatively frequently with this disease. So severe liver involvement, renal failure are quite commonly described. And there's typically some derangement of liver function tests when patients present. Meningoencephalitis is also well described in the literature, and patients may have a pneumonia or evidence of pulmonary edema as a complication of their presentation. And older patients are more likely to get severe disease manifestations. The blood tests show they can be unremarkable, but a low white cell count is something that we saw quite typically in our practice in Vietnam. And the mortality rate is around 6%, although given we haven't got a clear idea of the burden of disease, that's probably not an accurate estimate. And if it's untreated, the illness will go on for anything between 2 and 3 weeks. The differential diagnosis, as I've suggested, is very broad, includes other rickettsial diseases, dengue, chikungunya, leptospirosis, and in many parts of the world it's made as a clinical diagnosis. So it's often referred to as a doxycycline-responsive fever. There are diagnostic tests which are available, so immunofluorescence, which is often not available where it's needed. Rapid tests are becoming increasingly available, which are very useful in endemic areas. Culture is difficult and is really only done in research settings. And again, PCR is available, but typically in research settings and not in areas where it's most needed. The treatment in terms of duration and the optimal agent to choose is relatively under researched, but like African tick typhus, doxycycline is the treatment of choice. And again, similar to African tick typhus, 5 to 7 days of doxycycline, 200 milligrams once daily, is sufficient. Azithromycin is used in pregnancy, again, very similar to African tick typhus. There's also some evidence that rifampicin or chloramphenicol are also effective agents. And there is some concern from data in from Lao that shorter courses are associated with higher levels of relapse with this infection. So there are many questions about the optimal way of treatment, whether combination treatment for severe disease may be better, whether there's a role for chemoprophylaxis. And it's possible that people who take doxycycline as malaria prophylaxis when they're visiting parts of the tropics may be protected from scrub typhus. And I'm going to move on now to Baz. Thank you.
So I think I drew the short straw when the rickettsia were handed out, murine typhus. So I find that rickettsia are a slightly murky area with not very sensitive or specific diagnostics and very general clinical syndromes, and nowhere is this more so than in murine typhus. Luckily, murine typhus is perhaps the least severe of all of them. Like the others, it's a rickettsial disease, a small gram-negative intracellular bacteria, and it's transmitted by fleas, so it's otherwise known as flea-borne typhus or endemic typhus. Classically by rat fleas, and it's associated with rats. But cat fleas can also transmit Rickettsia typhi, as well as their own Rickettsia, Rickettsia felis, which is one of the spotted fever Rickettsia. Whereas the other Rickettsia are geographically confined, Rickettsia typhi and murine typhus is described on every populated continent on the planet. It's associated with rats, and rats have got everywhere. Because of the association with rats, it's much more of an urban and suburban disease in contrast to scrub typhus in areas where both are endemic. And this is nicely illustrated in a study, again, from the group in Laos, who did a seroprevalence study. So this wasn't looking at acute illness, this was looking at antibody, in 2,000 adults in the capital of Laos, Vientiane. And on the left, you can see that murine typhus has hot spots in the central, more built-up areas, whereas scrub typhus is almost a mirror image with the hot spots in the more peripheral areas, which are more rural. And the figures stack up with this. Murine typhus was positive in about 30% of adults in the urban areas, but still about 15% of the adults in the rural areas, and scrub typhus was the exact reverse, 30% in rural and 15% in urban. Again, not acute disease, but nicely illustrating how the two have slightly different ecological niches. It's a very common cause of undifferentiated fever when we look with our rather insensitive and non-specific tests. So a study done in Hanoi, where I work, at the referral hospital in Bac Mai, published last year by a group including some researchers from Nagasaki, found that about 30% of undifferentiated fevers were rickettsia typhi, murine typhus, and a similar percentage were scrub with some overlap. Now, this was all done serologically, and quite a lot of them were with a single serological test, which is not a recommended way of diagnosing this disease, but often it is all that you have. But really, good data are very rare in rickettsial disease, and in particular with murine typhus. And the reason for that is that murine typhus, even more than the other diseases, is very nonspecific. Fever, headache, arthralgia, that could be anything. Rash does happen, but it usually happens after about 7 days of fever, and a lot of patients are presenting before that now. The rash also, the incidence of the rash varies in the literature, can be hard to spot in darker skin, and can just occur in 1 in 5 patients. And this disease, because it's flea-borne, perhaps, does not usually have an eschar. So again, one of the distinguishing markers of the other two rickettsial infections is lacking. So you really have a very nondescript illness. But it can be more severe. The mortality is estimated to be about 1%, but you can get confusion, you can get a meningoencephalitis, usually again after a prolonged course of fever, so sort of 7 days of fever, then progressing into a meningoencephalitis. The CSF findings are similar to a sort of aseptic meningitis with a lymphocytic CSF, not usually a lot of cells, maybe up to about 600 or 700. Protein may be slightly raised, but the glucose is usually okay, and it's usually a mononuclear infiltrate. But again, that describes a multitude of illnesses. So it really is a diagnosis that has to be made on clinical suspicion and a trial of therapy with doxycycline. Although severe disease is less common in murine typhus, because the disease seems to be more common, in the really quite in-depth study from the group in Laos looking at meningoencephalitis in Laos, it was a similar number that had murine typhus as had scrub typhus, probably because of a larger denominator. Happily, both will respond to the same therapy. In the lab, you again don't really get any clues. You may have a bit of anemia, but you may not. You may have a raised white cell count. You may have a low white cell count. Low platelets, again, not very helpful, and slightly raised liver enzymes. So this picture is really very similar to other diseases that are endemic in many, many urban areas, like dengue, alpha viruses, the other rickettsia. People have tried to tease out things that are more specific for murine typhus compared to, for example, dengue. People say that the fever may persist for longer, but that doesn't help you if you're seeing somebody with a shorter duration of fever. The white cell count is more usually raised than in dengue, but not to a level that will help you. And the liver enzymes are more often raised than in dengue, but again, both can occur in both. So it's really not possible to adequately distinguish them. Treatment and diagnosis. So diagnosis, as I said, usually clinical. The gold standard is immunofluorescence with two samples, an acute and a convalescent sample. PCR is useful, but it's not very sensitive. It can be done on blood, can be done on CSF in cases where there is a meningoencephalitis. And in specialist centers, you can do culture. And that was something that they did in Laos when they did these big studies. Treatment, again, doxycycline, chloramphenicol, and probably azithromycin. People debate over the use of quinolones in this disease. We think quinolones are not very useful for scrub typhus. We think they may be useful for murine typhus, but because you may be having difficulty distinguishing the two, it's probably safest to go with doxycycline. So this is just a summary slide because I, for one, find the rickettsia and their vectors and distributions and so on quite confusing. So this is just a summary of all of the rickettsial groups. So we classically talk about three groups, the scrub typhus group, the typhus group, and the spotted fever group. And then these are the vectors. So the one we haven't talked about is epidemic typhus, Rickettsia prawazekii, louse-borne disease, and that's because it's really quite uncommon now. We've talked, Jamie talked about the mite-borne scrub typhus. Mites also transmit Rickettsia acari, which causes spotted fever. And then David talked about tick-borne spotted fever group, particularly Rickettsia canori and Rickettsia africana. So challenging diagnoses, all of them. Very little data on returning travellers because of that, perhaps. Clinical suspicion and a trial of treatment is really the way to go. And again, there's not a lot of work done on length of treatment, combinations of treatment, or resistance in rickettsia, which is starting to be a concern.